Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Niels Tygesen has been a senior economist, a leading advisor and statesman on the European monetary stage for several decades. Along with Alexandre Lamfalussy, he is one of the two economists who diluted the serried ranks of central bankers on the Delors Committee, whose report paved the way for the Maastricht Treaty. He is author, jointly with Daniel Grove, of the best and most comprehensive book on the advent of EMU, and a sage expert on all aspects of the past ERM and the current and future monetary union of Europe. And we're very fortunate to have him speak to us at this stage as the European system of central banks is being set up and we are moving forward rapidly towards the euro land of the 11th, starting as at the beginning of next year. But to me, Niels is much more than a great European monetary expert. He's a very long-standing friend. At the outset of the 1960s, he, Frank Edwards, who is now in the audience over from Columbia, and I were all doing our graduate work together at Harvard. And that was a very nice time. Those of you who are doing research now won't possibly believe that it's a lot more fun and pleasant to do research on a full-time basis than to spend your life teaching people doing research. I have to say that not all the theory we were taught then stood the test of time and experience. And Niels today embodies more experience with European monetary issues than virtually anyone else I can think of. And so it's a great privilege this evening to get the benefit of his wisdom. Niels.
Thank you very much, Chairman, for these extremely kind words. And thank you for the hospitality which I've enjoyed here at the London School of Economics for the past 2.5 months. Lord Kingstown, Lord Rolle, ladies and gentlemen, in this lecture, which I have called EMU, Britain and Other Outsiders, I want to address three different but interrelated subjects. First, now that the decision to start EMU has been taken in an almost anticlimactic way, and the most controversial issues of the transition are therefore behind us, it may be useful to recall still some of the main arguments in the economic evaluation of the project. It seems to me that a large number of academic economists, by presenting theoretical possibilities and risks as likely challenges to the functioning of EMU, have contributed to developing an excessively agnostic attitude in the public debate. And I shall try to illustrate that point by some examples. Secondly, I do see challenges to the harmonious evolution of policy making in the European Central Bank and at the political level. They are of a more practical and institutional nature, relating to the continuing national preoccupations of policymakers at a time when joint policies have to be formulated and implemented. And this brings me to the functioning of the European Central Bank as a truly integrated institution and to the new informal Council of Finance Ministers, the so-called Euro 11. Third and not least, I want to look at Britain and EMU in the light of the present government's open-ended strategy for eventual entry into EMU. Looking at it from the outside, and certainly not without sympathy, I do come from an out country myself, I offer some reasons why I think the British attitude is too open-ended and why there could be a case for an accelerated process of preparing for entry and how that process might be designed. Otherwise, events could well unfold in a way that would be frustrating both for Britain and for the initial EMU participants. I look in that context also at the attitudes in the other two voluntary out countries of Sweden and Denmark. Throughout the lecture, time constraints will obviously force me to be more assertive and more superficial than I would like. Most of the arguments are developed more fully in a book I recently published with Daniel Gross, as Charles was kind enough to refer to, and those with patience and a taste for a less polemical presentation may appreciate that longer version. Now, the theory of optimum currency areas has provided the economist with the most useful checklists of whether a country can have benefits from participating in a single currency area. Unfortunately, the vagueness and the static character of the criteria, as well as the failure to give full attention to the alternatives to monetary union, has, in my view, imparted a certain bias against EMU in much of the academic debate on the subject. That has left many economists and non-economists with the conclusion that EMU can only be understood in political terms. Of course, nobody would deny that EMU is a political project and that that consideration may well have been dominant for many of the main actors, such as Chancellor Kohl. But monetary union would not now be underway if it did not have a stronger backing in economic arguments as perceived by large segments of business, trade unions, and financial market participants than the bulk of professional economist literature suggests. What are the causes of this gap in perceptions, and who is closer to reality? Maybe the main weakness of the analytical framework of optimum currency area theory lies in its inadequate attention to the alternative. Theory implies implicitly that the alternative to a country's participation in a monetary union is either a well-functioning system of tightly managed exchange rates, where realignments take place occasionally to correct fundamental disequilibria, or a system of floating rates, somewhat reminiscent of the ideal state of such a system outlined by Milton Friedman, Harry Johnson, and others, where markets provide smoothly a safety valve for the residual differences between economic performances and policies in two areas. But both of these benchmark cases appear now excessively optimistic when one considers what the alternative to EMU would be. Now, in Europe, of course, there has been a tendency to see a managed exchange rate system as the main alternative. But the foreign exchange turmoil in 1992-93 demonstrated that such confidence was misplaced. A system of fixed rates, where the possibility of realignments had not been eliminated, is very vulnerable in a state of high capital mobility, which pushes countries beyond cooperation towards full-scale abolition of national monetary autonomy. Without this final step, the European exchange rate mechanism would have remained prone to speculative attacks, as Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa had already argued in 1988. Now, we have plenty of models in the academic literature on speculative attacks on currencies. Some of them, the early literature, first-generation models, assume that countries pursue somewhat divergent policies, and in the end, foreign exchange reserves are exhausted, and a speculative attack will occur somewhat before that time, as speculators anticipate correctly what is happening. And that may give a reasonably good description of some of the crises around the Italian lira, the peseta, maybe the Swedish krona, in 1992. Later, in 1993, and again over the summer of that year, there were speculative attacks also on currencies with good fundamentals. These attacks can be illustrated by other types of models where speculators gain if they correctly anticipate that governments are developing a dislike to the continued defense of their currencies, to the cost of defending them by means of high interest rates. As recession dragged on, particularly France was seen to develop such a reluctance and an urge to follow the British example to leave the ERM. Now, these expectations, in fact, proved wrong. There was no easing of monetary policy in the remaining countries in the ERM. Even after governments took the unprecedented step of widening the fluctuation margins in the system dramatically in August of that year to 15% either way. That created two-way risk for speculators, while the maintenance of central rates suggested that the system was still unchanged. The relaxed EIM has functioned well, but it would be naive, I think, to regard that as a possible alternative to monetary union, because the disciplining factor has clearly, over the past few years, been the approach to monetary union itself. So if calls for delays in monetary union had been listened to, then no doubt countries would have tried to hold on to such a system. But in that atmosphere, small differences in policy would have been overinterpreted in markets, and it's doubtful whether the system could have survived any realignments. Now, for these reasons, a system of managed exchange rates doesn't seem to be a viable alternative to monetary union in Europe. But could the other benchmark of flexible exchange rates do so, provided fluctuations in such a system were dampened by a commitment to low and parallel inflation rates in several countries? This is, of course, of particular relevance to a country such as the UK, which has an inflation target. Unfortunately, the answer here also appears to be negative, because the experience with inflation targets suggests that even when that policy is highly successful in terms of its main criterion, and it does deliver low inflation, it cannot deliver also exchange rate stability. To look outside Europe, Canada has had an impressive inflation record over a number of years, similar to or a bit better than that of the United States. But still, this has not prevented the Canadian dollar from fluctuating widely against the US dollar. And more to the point, UK inflation in parallel to continental Europe has not prevented sterling from moving over a wide range between a Deutschmark rate of 225 to 310 over the past few years. If one takes the middle point of that range as close to a longer run equilibrium, we are talking about fluctuations of plus minus 15% in both directions. And the relevant point, I think, is to discuss whether such swings are acceptable. Now, if one perceives, therefore, the alternative to monetary union as either a system of managed rates or prone to speculative attacks, or as a regime of flexible rates with a lot of excess volatility, then the answer may well be somewhat different from the comparison that is implicitly made in optimum currency area theory. And economists should be engaged in some soul-searching while they teach international economics, emphasizing the instability of exchange rates, and adopt a rather different posture when they debate the pros and cons of EMU. I think the real question is whether the creation of EMU eliminates costly exchange rate volatility to a degree which makes the lost opportunity of allowing the exchange rate to move in the rare cases when there are important elements of macroeconomic adjustment to be made acceptable. As you will have gathered, my answer to that would be yes. Now, since this is an essential issue when it comes to evaluating British preparations for entry into EMU, it may be worthwhile to extend the argument a little bit further in two directions. First, by looking at the reasons why some European or many European countries appear so keen on eliminating all exchange rate variability. And secondly, by asking how large would exchange rate changes have to be in order to bring about significant macroeconomic adjustments. On the first point, two elements explain, in my view, the attachment, some British observers would call it the obsession, of many Europeans with full exchange rate stability. First is, not having a single currency would make it difficult to fully implement and sustain the single market. And second, even short-term exchange rate volatility has significant costs. The first point is often disputed by British and American observers, with a remark that free trade in goods and services does develop smoothly even between countries which permit a high degree of flexibility in their currencies. But the single market has ambitions that go far beyond that. Those that underpin, for example, US-Canadian trade, they extend into the harmonization of standards, monitoring of subsidies, competition policy, in some areas outright common policies, common agricultural policy. Not all these efforts may be laudable, but they do build on a common and unequivocal unit of account in order to advance. As regards the second point, It is uncontroversial, of course, that there are transaction costs and other costs relating to exchange rate variability, which would be disappearing with the emergence of a single currency. These costs depend on the degree of variability. Bid-ask spreads in foreign exchange markets, as well as hedging costs, are directly related to variability. The most recent estimate in view of the experience of the early and mid-1990s is that these costs amount to about 1% of community GDP, a study by the IFO Institute in Munich. European multinational companies regard this as much too low a figure. Even disregarding this latter view, the potential gain from the single currency is not negligible, and it is certainly the equivalent of 1 to 2 years benefits of this order of magnitude would be enough to cover all the costs of the conversion to the single currency that are often now advanced as a major argument against it. But there is an additional argument. Economists have tended to dismiss further macroeconomic effects of the elimination of exchange rate variability with reference to the difficulties that empirical studies have long had in finding any impact on trade flows. Even the least agnostic findings have suggested only a boost to intra-European trade flows of about 1% as a result of eliminating the monthly variability of exchange rates. These modest effects have been rationalized mainly with reference to the possibilities of hedging. I have long had doubts about whether the macroeconomic effects of exchange rate variability in the short run could really be confined in this way. If one is inspired on the one hand by the work of Krugman on the implications of variability for the evolution of a wait-and-see attitude in firms engaged in international trade, where firms follow a pricing-to-market strategy and hence experience major swings in profit margins when the exchange rate moves. And on the other hand, the recurrent debate in some European countries, in Germany not least, about the value of Germany of a very stable exchange rate vis-a-vis important European trading partners. Then Daniel Gross and I have in our recent book tried to see if we could observe for Germany and for the other major EU economies a direct linkage for monthly exchange rate variability to the of the EMU currencies to changes in unemployment, in the unemployment rate, or in the percentage rate of change of employment in manufacturing. Somewhat to our own surprise, we did find significant quantitatively important effects of these indicators on macroeconomic performance in Germany. As an illustration, the increase in monthly variability of the Deutschmark against an index of other EMU currencies between 1994 and 1995, when European currency markets experienced some additional turmoil, could explain a 1 percentage point rise in the German unemployment rate from 8% to 9%, not a negligible result. And similarly, broadly similar results have been found for three other large countries in the first EMU group, France, Italy, and Spain, though not, I must say, for the United Kingdom. Obviously, such results are preliminary and only suggestive. Some colleagues have found them implausible because they should be seen together with the relatively low estimates of price sensitivity in international trade, which we also report. But the paradox can be explained. It is not implausible that trade flows could be sensitive, and more sensitive even, to the changes in the volatility of exchange rates than to changes in their level. There may be a trade-off between these two dimensions to the extent that an increase in volatility by generating more uncertainty about the permanent level of the exchange rate will tend to reduce price elasticities. That is the argument of Krugman in his analysis of inertia of observed trade flows when volatility in the dollar-yen exchange rate, admittedly much more dramatically, shot up in the 1980s. This line of reasoning can also help to understand the support of German industry and trade unions for the participation of Germany in EMU, in contrast, of course, to the skepticism which we normally hear more about from German savers vis-a-vis the project. I think it's too early to dismiss the macroeconomic benefits of the single currency by viewing them as arising only from some relatively modest savings in transactions and hedging costs. The latter may be the easiest to qualify, but not the most significant. I turn now to the second extension of the argument, drawing once more on classical optimum currency area theory. When are changes in nominal exchange rate appropriate for macroeconomic adjustment? The celebrated asymmetric or country-specific shocks are seen by many economists as the essential argument for preserving national currencies and hence the possibility of adjusting their external value. Robert Mundell's pioneering 1961 article took as its starting point demand shifts between domestic and foreign products in a world of sticky prices and limited factor mobility. Such shifts become more likely the more specialized the economies are. Peter Kennan later extended Mundell's model, which had assumed full specialization, to diversified economies such as those we have in Europe, between which demand shifts are less likely and in which supply shocks have more similar effects. Whatever will pose a threat to monetary union, it will hardly be a shift from German to Italian or Spanish goods, and even less so after EMU has unified monetary policy through the ECB and imposed constraints on divergences between national budgetary policies. In EMU, one will no doubt continue to observe non-policy disturbances which have a particularly strong impact on a particular country. But such regions are unlikely to correspond to nation states in EMU, and their problems could not, as Mundell himself was the first to point out, and indeed the last to remind us of in a recent article in the Wall Street Journal. He corrected by a realignment between national currencies. They should lead to changes in relative prices and relative remunerations of factors. The main question is therefore, in EMU as it was before EMU, whether these mechanisms work more or less well inside a particular country. EMU doesn't make much of a difference in this respect. This puts the most used argument against EMU, the singling out of asymmetric shocks as the main impediment to the single currency, into a more realistic perspective. It's not enough to demonstrate that over the past two or three decades, the correlation between GDP growth rates has been much less than perfect in Europe. In order to evaluate the need for retaining the exchange rate as an adjustment mechanism, it is necessary to isolate those disturbances which are truly external in nature, because it's with the purpose of softening the impact of such shocks that the optimum currency area theory initially advocated the use of the exchange rate. Yet it is only rarely that this distinction is made in empirical work. Some researchers approach it indirectly by distinguishing between supply and demand shocks, of which only the latter should be dependent on national policies. But this doesn't go far enough. Some shocks to supply, such as wage explosions, have also been generated by divergent economic policies, which are irrelevant in EMU. The study with Gross we use to identify externally generated shocks. The difference between the growth rates of exports from an EU member state and growth rates of exports from the whole of the European Union. There are some striking examples. Yet even such a measure exaggerates the problem that would be faced in EMU, which I can illustrate by means of the most often quoted example of a major external and asymmetric shock: the dissolution of the Soviet Union on the Finnish economy around 1991. The standard presentation of this case is that the virtual disappearance of a major foreign market was a decisive asymmetric shock requiring the major devaluations of the Finnish currency observed in 91 and 92. Now, the facts are that Finnish export volumes overall fell by about 6% in 1991, while those of the EU as a whole rose by nearly 5%, a striking difference, the largest observed in this period. However, the main reason was much less specific and external than implied by this standard presentation. If the Soviet market had developed fully in step with other markets for Finland, total exports would still have fallen by more than 5%. The dissolution of the USSR, however dramatic and unique it was not the main explanatory factor, even in this case. A long inflationary boom in Finland, fueled by expansionary policies, had weakened competitiveness and exposed Finnish industry to the arrival of recession. So even in this apparently unique case, the external shock, asymmetric shock, was not decisive. Now, have external shocks on the whole been important in shaping internal balance, as measured by the most sensitive indicator we have, the unemployment rate? Somewhat surprisingly, it is difficult to demonstrate such an impact in the European countries. Among the EU countries, the relationship of export shocks to employment is only significant for one open economy, namely Belgium. And if one cannot even confirm the importance of export shocks to the evolution of employment or unemployment, the assertion that retaining the instrument of exchange rate changes, that is essential for macroeconomic balance, must also be somewhat weakened. Now, the implications of this conclusion is, at a minimum, that external shocks have to be very large before they have a significant impact on employment. This point can be illustrated by a back-of-the-envelope calculation for a typical European country. The ratio of exports is there about 30% of GDP. Over a 2 to 3 year horizon, most macro models would estimate the elasticity of the export volumes with respect to the real exchange rate at about 1/2. It would then take a 20% devaluation in real terms to produce the increase of output of about 3%, which, according to Okun's law and other evidence, is required typically to cut 1 percentage point off the unemployment rate. Although this back of the envelope calculation is excessively simple, it does suggest that giving up the exchange rate change makes only a modest difference to the macroeconomic performance of the EU economies. Finally, we have the argument that if only the continental economies had more flexible labor markets, EMU could be introduced, but they don't. In other words, only if firms can adjust their labor forces flexibly, and only if wage differentials can be allowed to reflect to a larger extent productivity differentials, could the potential benefits of EMU be reaped. This argument appeared to be put quite succinctly by the IMF in a recent issue of World Economic Outlook. There can be no disagreement that EMU would work better if these dimensions of flexibility were solidly in place than without them. It's also highly likely that the welfare gains for the combination of labor market and fiscal or social security reforms required exceed those of moving to EMU. My observation is simply that the two reforms are sufficiently independent of each other to warrant the implementation of EMU without awaiting the other reforms. The welfare gains from EMU would still be attainable. If EMU can then, in addition, act as a stronger spur to structural reforms in European countries than alternative macroeconomic regimes, as indeed seems plausible, that would provide an additional argument for EMU. Now, there are reasons indeed for regarding EMU as a risky project. I will go into them now in the next section of my lecture. They relate to the way in which monetary union will work. But I hope that what I have said so far is sufficient to justify the initial point I made, that much of the economics literature on EMU has had a tendency to be biased against the project because it has played up some risks that are conceivable but unlikely to pose the major challenge that they are thought to do. The economic risks of not moving to EMU would also have to be considered, and they seem in many respects more serious. Now, turning to policymaking in the European Central Bank and the Euro 11 Council, there's a new departure in a double sense. Only monetary policy is being centralized, while national governments continue to have prime responsibility for budgetary policies. And secondly, both types of policies are subjected more strongly to rules than has been the case in national states typically so far. And both of these elements, experiments in limited delegation to new institutions, are of course risky. Will they work? I first look at the ECB, the most radical innovation in EMU. The new central bank is a truly federal institution with a clear mandate, price stability, assuming, of course, that it will quantify its objectives as it has said it will, and with a high degree of independence from political authorities. Decision-making will be centralized in the governing council of the ECB, while implementation will, to a large degree, be decentralized through the participating national central banks. It's natural to compare the system to the central banking systems in the two large federated states, Germany and the United States, on which the ECB has been modeled. All three institutions have as their main policy-making body, we think of the Federal Open Market Committee in the United States, the Bundesbank Council in Germany, and the Governing Council of the ECB, they are all bodies composed partly of regional central bank presidents who are partly of board members who are placed at the center of decision making and charged with implementing the decisions of the council. In the ECB, the position of the board must be considered to be weaker than in the German or US models. Numerically, the six ECB board members are in a clear minority, 6 out of 17, in contrast to the FOMC, for example, where the board members can outvote the 5 Federal Reserve Bank presidents who can at any one time vote in a meeting. In addition, the Federal Reserve Board has important policy instruments by itself, notably the discount rate. While within the Bundesbank Council, the 8 members of the Directorium in Frankfurt could in principle be outvoted by the 9 regional Landeszentralbank Presidenten, but the former have the advantage there of being permanently at the operational center in Frankfurt. The ECB board will initially have neither the analytical strength nor the operational handles of the 2 national counterparts. It will not be as dominant in preparing decisions because the ECB staff will at least initially be much smaller relative to the analytical policy-oriented staff of the participating national central banks than are the staffs of either the Federal Reserve Board or the Bundesbank Directorium in Frankfurt. In the US and Germany, regional representatives taking part in central bank decisions obviously arrive at the meetings thoroughly briefed on the problems of their own region. but the documents underlying monetary policy decisions are those prepared by the central staff on the basis of aggregate data for the country. In the ECB, where the staff is smaller and the national central bank governors will be keen to impose their mark on the decisions, they may speak up primarily on the basis of the situation in their own country, with which they will continue to be most familiar. The ECB board members could have a difficult time in keeping the discussions to the EMU-wide inflation rate and monetary aggregates. Maybe, one of my few humorous suggestions, some of the security guards in the ECB could be assigned the task of checking the briefcases of council members, permitting only a few pages of national material to enter the meeting room. It is in this atmosphere that I find the resistance of Mr. Deutschenberg and his colleagues understandable to a full blast of Anglo-Saxon transparency in central banking, including publication of voting records and obligations for ECB officials to appear even before national parliaments. The national central bank governors will be subject to considerable pressures from their own national environments, in contrast to their counterparts in the US and Germany. And they remain part of a national political structure, despite declarations of their independence. Even though they are not permitted to take instructions from the latter environment, they will have some difficulty reconciling a national role with their new role of having a European responsibility, including that of communicating ECB decisions. It could be disastrous after each meeting in the ECB Council to have 11 press conferences by individual central bank governors emphasizing all somewhat different perspectives on the decisions that have been taken. It would be preferable to leave as much of the communication and the speech making in general to members of the board, because it will be a long time before all members of the ECB Council could safely speak up as frequently and with as many nuances as do, for example, the members of the German Bundesbank Council. They should be allowed first to develop the common perspectives and collegiality which comes naturally within a central banking system of a nation state. Now, the problems of diversified preparations of decisions are compounded by ambitions to decentralize operations to a high degree. When the plans for a common central bank were drawn up nearly a decade ago in the Delors Report, as Lord Kingstown will no doubt remember, one intention was to centralize central banking operations and the authority to undertake them. Even sometimes during the transition to EMU, the French had in particular the idea of centralizing foreign exchange operations. And Alexandre Lamfalussy, who later became president of the EMI, advocated a pooling of operations early in the transition because he regarded the accumulation of joint operational experience as a prerequisite for the good functioning of an ECB in the final stage. Not only does the ECB start without such an experience, it appears unlikely to develop one itself. As the plans for the ECB developed, the emphasis has de facto reverted to the formulation rejected in the Maastricht Treaty that operations should be decentralized to the maximum extent possible. Current plans envisage no direct presence of the European Central Bank in the foreign exchange or money markets. Advocates of this approach point to the United States, where the absence of operational activities for the Federal Reserve Board does not appear to have impeded the efficiency of US monetary policy. However, in the United States, operational activity is delegated to the Reserve Bank in the main financial center, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In EMU, the intention is to delegate to all 11 participating central banks. It's difficult to avoid the impression that this decentralized approach has been adopted because leaving the ECB to handle many or most operations would have given a boost to Frankfurt as a financial center, which in the end proved unacceptable to several other countries, not least to the initial proponents of centralization, the French. When the plans for EMU were drafted, the location of the ECB was, of course, not known. It's possible that I exaggerate this problem of operational decentralization. The EMI staff is confident that their successors in the ECB, largely themselves, I suppose, will be able to monitor all operations by the constituent national central banks in such a way as to eliminate any inefficiencies. This is certainly feasible with modern information technology, though it is more complex and costly as a way of conducting monetary policy. In some respects, the chosen method of operations may also make the build-up of the ECB's credibility in the markets more difficult. This is true in particular for foreign exchange operations, where the whole point of pooling a significant amount of international reserves in the ECB, initially 50 billion euros, with the possibility of subsequent call-ups, must have been to give the ECB a clear status as a market participant. In short, I think some initial concern about the ECB must relate to risks of insufficient centralization in the preparation of decisions and possibly also in implementation. We may have a more indecisive, confused central bank than is generally imagined. This is the opposite concern, of course, of that expressed more often in the public debate, not least in this country, namely that a centralized monetary policy would be a factor of divergence because the effects of changes in the policy instruments, mainly short-term interest rates, are different between EMU participants. Can this provide an economic explanation of why national interests in EMU are still such a strong reality? We do have a few empirical studies available now about the monetary transmission mechanism in different European countries. They do give some support to the idea that differences in financial structure, particularly the level of indebtedness and maturity structure of debt, may initially be sufficiently important to raise controversies over the implementation of a uniform policy. But interestingly, if you look closely at the studies, most recently a paper by the IMF, the differences in transmission mechanism relate primarily to the very short term. The time lags are shorter in some countries than in others. But the impact on the slow group ultimately builds up to a higher level than in the former group. There are, however, a couple of interesting points to note about these comparisons. The two groups of countries do not correspond to the distinction between core and periphery normally used. The UK has a transmission mechanism which looks more similar to Germany's than do the French and Italian transmission mechanisms. And secondly, the differences in financial structure are, of course, not immutable. After some years of hopefully fairly stable and low interest rates with a flatter yield curve than has been the typical experience in the past, the preference for borrowing short-term at variable interest rates must be expected to fade. For both of these reasons, the problem whether one size fits all seems to be less crucial than is generally implied. But the issue certainly has the capacity to create tensions initially in EMU and to further encourage a nationalist rather than an aggregate view of the design of policy. It's also in this context that I justify some concern about the incomplete centralization of procedures and operations. Some important decisions have had to await the setup of the ECB, clarification of the strategy for monetary policy, the formulation of the inflation target, the formulation of the instrument of reserve requirements, possibly, and some principle for the lender of last resort operations. Clarifications on all of these issues in the months to come are important in putting to rest any ideas that the ECB will not be a well-integrated institution capable of taking decisions firmly and decisively. Even during 1999 to 2001, the period when most observers in financial markets still appear to regard the institution as less than fully robust. For non-participants in the ECB, de facto from next month, that will imply a dramatic change in working habits. The central bank governors, their alternates, and their staff working on technical committees in the EMI will be spared the routine trips to Frankfurt, but they will soon come to look nostalgically at the influence they had in the past and the information to which they had automatic access. The irregular and purely consultative meetings in the so-called General Council of the ECB, maybe quarterly meetings, would be a poor substitute. While this has long been foreseen in the central banks, though not fully perceived by the general public, the emergence of an informal council of finance ministers from EMU participants is a more recent development. In the light of the adoption of the Stability Pact, committing EMU participants to aim for balanced budget on average over the cycle and with no political oversight of the independent ECB envisaged in the Maastricht Treaty, one could well have asked whether the limited tasks assigned to EMU finance ministers could really justify all the debate of recent months. But it is clear now that France, supported by some other countries, have had some success in widening the agenda of the Euro 11, somewhat beyond the original ideas. No concessions has been made to give the new body a role that will curtail the independence of the ECB itself. It's not justified to draw any different conclusions from the recent nominations of the ECB board, which was from a start a political decision to be made. That creates no precedence for governments to intervene jointly or individually in subsequent policy-making decisions in the ECB. But there remains some uncertainty as to what role the Euro 11 will assume. Will it look primarily at the aggregate performance of participants, as expressed in the collective current account or in the rate of exchange of the euro? Or will it go beyond formal monitoring of the Stability Pact rules towards an extended role in policy coordination and surveillance of individual countries? The latter has become more likely, and any such tendency might be strengthened if there's a change in government in Germany, because the present German government has been the strongest opponent of this trend. Anyway, the ECOFIN, comprising all the 15 finance ministers, itself has widened its agenda into regular reviews of the implementation of the single market and of national labor market policies. And the Euro 11 is likely to make a similar extension of the agenda. The change for finance ministers not in EMU will be less dramatic than for the central bankers, though their meetings in ECOFIN will become briefer, less argumentative than in the past, because there will usually be a prior position by the Euro 11. These developments are a natural spillover effect of EMU and could hardly be resisted in the way that Britain and other outsiders initially tried to do by a mixture of legal objections and a request for observer status in the new body. If the importance of the Euro 11 increases steadily, that would be a clear indication that EMU is working and that the loss of influence in remaining outside is more important than would have been the case with a purely rule-bound mechanism for policy making. That brings me to my final topic, the position of the outsiders and primarily Britain. The main policy document in Britain remains the Chancellor's statement to the House of Commons in October last year. That statement concluded that Britain was not ready to join in the first round. There was no constitutional bar to membership if in the end a single currency is successful and the economic case is clear and unambiguous. Then the government believes that Britain should be part of it, I was quoting. And the Chancellor then proceeded to set up 5 economic tests to define early in the next parliament whether such a case could be made. These tests were whether there can be sustainable convergence between Britain and the economies in EMU, whether there's sufficient flexibility to cope with change, the effects on investment, the impact on the financial service industry, and whether EMU is good for employment. My purpose in listing these tests, no doubt very well known to the audience, is not to discuss them in detail, but to explain why the Chancellor's statement was met with some disappointment in most EMU countries, despite the relief that in the future Britain was likely to move into the role of a constructive agnostic on EMU. While it was recognized from that the starting point of 1997-98 of cyclical divergence between Britain and other economies would raise very significant challenges for Britain's economic management if it were to enter EMU in the first group. There was disappointment about the vagueness of the tests and the lack of an expressed intention of taking steps designed to meeting the first and crucial one of more convergence. To most continental countries, Britain has converged in the sense of meeting the Maastricht criteria, though it still has obviously a cyclical problem. Other EU countries were reminded by the Chancellor's statement of the long-standing British reply to calls for Britain to join the ERM in the 1980s, when the time is ripe, was always the answer. A recent report of the Treasury Select Committee was also critical of the vagueness of the criteria and proposed some tightening. But more fundamentally, some cyclical divergence is not seen by other European countries as an insuperable obstacle to joining monetary union, when the underlying criteria for entry in the form of low inflation and sound public finances are met to the extent that is the case in Britain. Budgetary policies may have to be better equipped to take care of residual stabilization needs, notably by strengthening the workings of automatic stabilizers, as already discussed in a good report by Rupert Penn-Enrea and other economists in 1997. Since the election last year, 2 steps in economic policy making in the UK have moved the country closer to, in a sense, the framework in EMU. The first is the operational independence of the Bank of England on the basis of the mandate to achieve as closely as possible an inflation target of 2.5%. The second is the emphasis given in the 2 budget statements of July last year and March this year to the aim of a structural or cyclically adjusted budget position near balance. These 2 steps confirm that Britain has moved much closer to the rule-bound or target-constrained view of macroeconomic policies, which I outlined before as the core of EMU. The main stumbling block remains that of cyclical behavior, and the cyclical behavior of sterling in particular, and the absence and intended absence of Britain from any exchange rate cooperation in Europe. Since this issue is critical to the timing of the British decision to join, I want to elaborate a bit further on it. The British view is clear. Convergent policies, and in particular the pursuit of an inflation target of low inflation in EMU, should dampen swings in the sterling-euro exchange rate. With the wide margins in the ERM, in the future, ERM number 2, the British view is that the exchange rate criterion in the Maastricht Treaty has been eroded to an extent which makes de facto or ex post exchange rate stability the only relevant test of a country's preparedness in this area. All other member states, however, excluding Sweden, who has aligned herself on the British position, currently take the view that participation in EIM2 for a two-year period without devaluation does remain one of the criteria of admission to EMU, as it was for the recent selection to the first group. I've heard this view described as pedantic by, amongst others, the former chancellor, but it is, in my view, not difficult to justify it by economic arguments. A significant part of the process of entering EIM2 with its wide margins is the decision or the selection of a central rate against the euro. Choosing a rate close to, though not necessarily identical to, recent market rates offers an occasion for the entering country and its partners to evaluate in common the level of the exchange rate, and for financial markets to begin to form expectations of the new participants' policies in a forward-looking environment. Markets will no doubt assume, in analogy with what they did with respect to the currencies in the first group to enter EMU, that the central rate chosen will also be the conversion rate after the two-year initiation period. Given the historical instability of sterling vis-à-vis other European currencies over nearly three decades, it would indeed be strange for the first group of EMU participants to dispense from the entry requirement of prior participation in an exchange rate system in the one case where it seems more justified than in any other. The EIM criterion was put in the Maastricht Treaty to make sure that a country aspiring to participation in EMU had some minimum experience with an external objective for monetary policy prior to entry. A good inflation record is also a requirement, but it cannot fulfill a double role. There is already an inflation target in the treaty. The exchange rate criterion is not implied by a fulfillment of that target or that of long-term interest rate convergence, both of which should continue to be broadly met by Britain. So the exchange rate criterion cannot be regarded as simply redundant. It's important to avoid misunderstandings between Britain and partners on this important point, because it would come as an unpleasant surprise to most people in Britain if a positive referendum were to be held at some point that it could not immediately be followed or very quickly be followed by joining EMU, at least in the sense of setting the sterling euro conversion rate. The physical introduction of the euro in Britain would of course require, as it has done in other countries, a proper period of preparation. To me as an outsider, it would seem logical to say that the demonstrated ability to live with a stable exchange rate for some time could be the most single important indicator of convergence listed in the Chancellor's five tests. That would indicate above all that an active national monetary policy, which would anyway have to be given up after entry into EMU, was no longer seen as strictly necessary to serve the double purpose of locking in anti-inflationary gains and of contributing to smoothing the UK business cycle. Pegging to the euro would take care of the former, national budgetary policies of the latter. I recognize the objections that are made to this proposal. The recollection of the ejection of sterling from the EIM in September 92, when the exchange rate was not far from recent levels, against the other main European currencies, remains vivid in the minds of the public and the officials, who often were surprisingly quick to make a virtue out of the enforced departure. To rejoin a mechanism of fixed exchange rate where the possibility of realignments cannot be ruled out seems to be even more unpopular in Britain than monetary union itself. Furthermore, Britain chose, after departure from EMU, a different policy regime by emphasizing an inflation target and increasing transparency of monetary policy decisions, culminating so far in the instrument independence of the Bank of England from May 1997. The new policy framework has delivered fine results in terms of the inflation objective, now over a nearly five-year period. Transparency has been increased, most dramatically recently, and appears to be popular as a contribution to better public understanding of monetary policy. Furthermore, there is now a clear prospect that the ECB will be inspired in part by the British example and adopt, at least as a very important supplementary objective, a direct inflation target. And all of this must make it difficult to explain to the British public why one has to pass through a supposedly inferior regime with an exchange rate objective in order to get into EMU. It may indeed that the regime be inferior in most respects, except that it delivers what the inflation target regime cannot deliver, namely exchange rate stability. Now, if one accepts, of course, merely for the sake of the argument, that some experimentation with transitional regime of the EIM will be necessary, what would that imply for the timetable of a British referendum and other decisions? I think approximately the following. Sometime within the next 12 months, when more of the temporary strength of sterling has eroded, the government should aim to negotiate a central rate for sterling against the euro with the Euro 11 Council and the ECB. And before taking this step, the government should seek, maybe in confidence, despite the British preference for openness, the view of the Monetary Policy Council of the Bank of England on two issues. One, the compatibility of the proposed level of the exchange rate with the inflation objective, and secondly, the operational implications for the bank of accepting the constraints of the fluctuation margins of the EIM2. These margins need not be as wide as the plus minus 15 maximum permitted in the EIM2 outline. Narrow margins could no doubt be negotiated if Britain were to wish that. The central rate should obviously be chosen sufficiently low to make future devaluations of sterling highly unlikely. Now, if such a strategy could be implemented before mid-1999 and pursued successfully thereafter, the UK would indeed, in the view of everybody, have met the criteria for entering EMU, except the residual one of giving the Bank of England the full degree of independence required by the Maastricht Treaty. The final steps in this area could, however, be left until after the time of a referendum, as has been the practice elsewhere, awaiting a positive outcome of that vote. Under this scenario, a referendum could be held any time from mid-2001. This is earlier than envisaged by most commentators. The latest day of an election is the spring of 2002. But there are two additional considerations which suggest that it would be preferable to have the referendum earlier than 1st of January 2002. The first, the importance of which has been stressed to me by you, Charles, though I have heard it in my own country, is that the introduction of the new currency to replace the present national currencies in the course of the year 2002 is likely to be a period of maximum controversy over the project. The physical appearance of the euro will not be popular everywhere. A collective loss of the important part of the economic memory of citizens related to prices in their own currency will be perceived. The first half, maybe the whole of 2002, will not be a propitious time to campaign in favor of British participation. The British tabloids would have a field day in showing pictures of demonstrations by German pensioners who wrongly believe that the value of their savings has been cut in half, or recounting stories of inefficiencies, maybe even chaos, for some new users of the euro, maybe in the public sector. Planning for a referendum in 2002 could be a risky strategy. Now, a second consideration pointing to the same conclusion is that the euro will begin to appear also in non-EMU European countries from 2002. Tourists will expect to be able to use the euro in Britain, many domestic users too. In this situation, it would be preferable to have established a firm conversion rate for sterling rather than a floating rate. The euro will obviously become legal tender mandatory for UK users only after a further transition period similar to, though hopefully a bit shorter, than the three-year period the others are undergoing. In short, there are some arguments for saying that a referendum should either be held before 2002, in which case the euro could be in full circulation around 2003, or after that year, in which case, of course, the urgency of some of what I have said about EIM participation is reduced. Now, the authorities of EMU might do a little bit to encourage the British to take a more positive attitude to the EIM by strengthening the provisions of the system. I shall not go into that in detail. The system is rather vague and contains some worrisome aspects, reservations against interventions. But the main decision, of course, has to come from Britain. I spent some time on the British case, not only because it is of particular interest, I suppose, in London, but also because it is vitally important for the two other outsider countries. As a Scandinavian and a Dane, I cannot overlook the importance of the British decision to Sweden and Denmark. Let me take Sweden first, because she shares with Britain an experience of more than two decades of a highly unstable exchange rate vis-a-vis other European currencies, and no record of participation in the EIM. A brief Swedish effort of pegging ended with a costly defense of an overvalued currency and a transition to floating in 1992. Sweden also introduced inflation targets and is rightly proud of its achievements in this area. Sweden has rectified a public sector deficit of very large proportions. Sweden has no formal opt-out from EMU, but has unilaterally declared that the Swedish Parliament will decide to join later if it's in the national interest to do so, very reminiscent of Chancellor Gordon Brown. A government commission's report by seven independent economists and political scientists, Calmfors et al., they were actually some of the people I had in mind in my comments in the first section, took a rather agnostic view of the net benefits and costs of EMU, though it did underline that there were political costs also in remaining outside, the more so the larger the euro area. The Swedish Prime Minister, who now seems likely to continue in office for an additional 4 years after September this year, has said that any British decision will be watched very carefully in Sweden. The Swedish absence from the EIM and its intention not to join the EIM too has been criticized by European policymakers, notably central bankers, and by the European Commission. In the recent convergence report, Sweden was listed as not having qualified for EMU because of its failure to join EIM and to give the required degree of independence to the National Central Bank. The statement is of particular interest in setting a precedent for the British case. My own country, Denmark, obtained an opt-out from the EIM in a special protocol to the Maastricht Treaty, less far-reaching than the British one, not least because Denmark accepted all obligations during the transition. Danish voters subsequently exercised the opt-out unexpectedly by voting for the Maastricht Treaty in a second referendum only after the Danish government that the country would not join EMU. Denmark currently meets all the Maastricht convergence criteria, including participation in the EIM. Denmark has a record of participation in the tightest arrangement available ever since 1972. Central rate of the krona is unchanged vis-a-vis the Deutschmark for more than 11 years. And the Danish government has indicated it wants to negotiate a tight link to the euro, margins at least as narrow as the old EIM once the ECB is operational. The public finances have moved into surplus. In short, the objections to EMU in Denmark are purely political. Opinion polls continue to show a small majority against, mainly on the grounds that monetary union may have implications for political integration at a pace faster than appreciated by many Danes. Furthermore, the fact of having had the opt-out confirmed in a referendum means that it's difficult to raise the issue again, even if circumstances have changed, as they can well be argued to have changed with the start of a monetary union of 11 countries. In the Danish case, it may also be difficult to obtain a change in attitude, because the country could, in contrast to Britain, no doubt, achieve most of the benefits of monetary union through its policy of shadowing the euro closely, a free rider policy. For Denmark, it's less logical, therefore, for Sweden than to take inspiration from the British case. The Danish experience has been different and more positive. Yet the pragmatic desire to see how EMU actually performs before taking a final decision makes it likely that the three countries should be looked upon as one group. It would make a major impression on public opinion in Sweden and Denmark if Britain were to decide to join, or even to indicate a clearer strategy for preparing to do so. A reversal of opinion in the country which has traditionally shown by far the strongest hostility to the whole project would be a major event, not only in Britain and in Euroland, but also in the two other countries which have initially kept apart from the completion of the monetary unification process. Thank you very much.
Niels had some fairly strong comments on the external requirements for the UK to join EMU, and I think we ought to offer the audience a chance for 5 or 10 minutes, not more, to ask questions of him on that and any other point arising. Have I got any? Please.
Derek Lyons from PKP. I'd like to ask your view in terms of response to the British idea of waiting and seeing. It seems to me that there's two main reasons why Britain needn't rush into EU, as you suggest. First, the politics. The whole EU process has been driven by politics, whether there are positive economic arguments or not. The clearest example is the way in which the convergence criteria have been completely cut. Post-EU, there's every possibility, every likelihood that different countries, particularly the French, are going to put national interests above Eurodac interests. The early May meeting in Brussels was possibly the first sign of that. So it's not clear that the politics of EU after it starts will be as enthusiastic towards EU. There's no carrot now to encourage peripheral high-yielding or high-spending countries to observe fiscal rules. And second, in economic terms, if EU is as good as you suggest, then why don't we wait and see? Surely we should, here in Britain, wait to see how EU performs in the upstream and the downstream of the economic cycle. At the very least, what the Leader of the Opposition suggests is that we wait for 10 years. If EU is going to last all the time, it's as good as you suggest, then why should we rush? It's normally the financial markets which accused of being very short-term. It strikes me the whole political process is rushing this process unnecessarily.
I do take objection to the idea that there has been a fudge of the criteria. By a stroke of good luck and by tough decisions in several countries, not least in the southern half of Europe, countries managed, in fact, to meet the budget criteria. The one example one can discuss, which could be an exception to that, is France, which had some temporary one-off measures for 97. On the other hand, the fact that we now have projections for this year, not only from the national authorities at the European level, which suggests further declines in the deficits despite the nature of the one-off measures that were used in 97, I think gives some confidence that we are in a new world of economic policy relative to what we have seen in much of the 90s. You may say there was still a small element of fudge, but it was really extremely moderate. And fortunately, it was not necessary to do any fudging, I would say. Of course, one should not construct EMU on the basis merely of good luck in terms of an economic upswing over a short period. And I understand those who say we'd like to see how it performs in recession. But what is a recession? If we have the kind of somewhat muddled business cycle that we have seen on many occasions, there will always be an argument for saying, let us wait for the next one, which is more serious probably, which will test them more. So I think in practice, the argument that you want to see the quality of the EMU develop over a long period of time is an excuse for indefinite delay. The argument for hurry, I would not consider my own scheme hurrying one. It would still be only a decision by a referendum in 2001 at the earliest. That's the earliest feasible date I could think of. I wouldn't regard that as hurrying, given that others have started 2.5 years earlier, approximately. But it's, of course, also to contain the loss of influence on the policies on which Britain will also be dependent to a large extent. And surely with the sophistication of British economists, negotiators, there would be some significant influence from British participation. The arguments count for a lot. So I would say both as regards the European Central Bank and the Euro 11, it's very important to be there. And that argument may be the one that ultimately swings the political class in Britain into accepting the whole project of EMU rather than the economic arguments. So my defense is really, I have not argued for any particular hurry. I think we have enough evidence. You should not overlook that the European countries have managed themselves increasingly jointly, those that have gone into the first group of EMU over the past 5, maybe even longer, period of time. It's not a completely new venture.
An important part of your argument, Neil, is that the economic
itself really are not substantive arguments, either empirically or in your judgment. That raises a logical question, which is, what should the scope of common currency units be? And when do these economic arguments against the common currency begin to bite? I wonder if you could give sort of the type of reasoning you would go through to respond to a question like that, or more specifically, give us an example of a country that should not join the EMU and why, or even a hypothetical. And finally, I would say, well, with the globalization of the world, I mean, if we take your views, can we just extend them to a common currency for the entire world? Maybe the U.S. should be the next EMU member.
Maybe it's easiest to see the limit of the kind of a reasoning I was putting forward. If you look at some of the countries in Eastern Europe, I think they will probably need a longer transition period. We know both from economic theory, from watching a number of developing countries, recently industrialized countries, that the real exchange rate has to move quite a bit in the period of catching up. We've seen it in Asian countries. We are likely to see that again in Eastern Europe. It would be much harder to judge whether they are at the right level of exchange rate, and it would be an accident if their needs of real appreciation or sometimes maybe depreciation corresponded to the inflation differentials between them and the existing members of EMU. So I have a long horizon for the participation of Eastern European countries in EMU. I think it would be risky for them, given the initially quite large inflation differential they have and the strategy they have for a very gradual phasing out, and the industrial structure problems. So that's probably where I would draw the line. I would not exclude that one or two of them could be early entrants into EMU. But clearly there are points where the trends in productivity and where the shocks that faced by these countries are sufficiently different to warrant some variability of the exchange rate. I don't think it would be realistic to have a fixed exchange rate between the United States and the European Union, though some form of exchange rate cooperation may well turn out to be desirable, so that we don't have excessive swings in the exchange rate of the kind we had in the 1980s. And I do have some worries on that score, whether maybe there's too sharp a distinction, very fixed rates inside Europe, and no interest at all in exchange rate cooperation with the rest of the world. That may be excessive, but we cannot, of course, lump all countries together.
Yeah. I'm sure it would be wrong to use such a negative term as budget in terms of the criteria. But I think that surely news that you would accept that some very fine calculations have been made about the extent to which a number of the 11 have been judged to converge, even within the criteria laid down in the Maastricht Treaty. But having said that, what I've always found most difficult to understand is how the economists and bankers of the European countries have convinced themselves that henceforth we're going to get equality of performance within the whole European Union, so that in the convergence from henceforth is a permanent thing, and that the performance of the individual states, individual economies, has got to keep level with that of the best. I find that extremely unlikely, and surely as the years go by, the disparity of performance, productivity, between different countries, different parts of the European Union, will become increasingly obvious. And the corrective mechanism which exists in the United States, freedom of movement, simply doesn't apply.
I don't think full convergence of performance, as you say, is a necessary criterion for the functioning of monetary union. What we will see, no doubt, over the next decade or so is some continuing catching up of income levels, for example, in Southern Europe. In fact, these countries, which were thought initially to be the weak parts of the union, that would find it difficult to live with a fixed exchange rate, they reduced their inflation rate. They still have slightly better performance in productivity. They have some catching up to do. and they will no doubt outperform Germany and France, to take the two most logical examples. So the main strain, you can say, is really on the two core countries of Germany and France, and that will put pressure on them to perform better, to become a bit more flexible, not to do too many state interventions, to disband subsidies in Germany, etc. Whether they can do it, of course, remains to be seen. I think they can. I think that there is good evidence already over the past 5, 6 years, even 10 years, that convergence is improving. And it's not necessary to for them to have the same income levels in the at the outset. So I do share, of course, the importance of your question, but I think Mr. Tietmeyer may have overstated the case by saying that full convergence is required.
Take one last question.
As an old economist, let me ask you a bit of a scientist question. One has to assume that politics will also converge to some extent. There's a real problem, it seems, to many of us in Germany as well as in Britain, about whether French politics at the moment is converging, or indeed whether French assumptions about economic policy are converging. The French economic policy debate does seem to be very particular, and the weakest link, therefore, in the chain which you've been setting out does seem to many of us therefore to be whether the domestic politics of one of the two key members of the Union is capable of absorbing all of the lessons that the economists from outside the world they call would like them to accept, which would accept those lessons.
I do share your view that the weakest link in the construction is probably France. And in political science terms, I would say you have to think very carefully of what would an alternative government do to the one you have presently. Is participation even fully robust, or could shifts in voting patterns in the next election endanger one or major policies that go into EMU? And if you ask the questions in that way, France is not totally reassuring because of the pressures for somewhat more protectionist attitude in some policies, towards a more xenophobic attitude. It's not completely reassuring. On the other hand, the substance seems to be quite solid. After all, we have had changes in governments in the past. That did continue after much rhetoric in election campaigns, basically the same policies. And the people who, of course, participate in European negotiations are struck by the continuity of the French views and presence in the negotiations. But your question is, of course, slightly different. It is about the congruence of these continuing views and the growing frustrations in parts of the French population. But we should not exaggerated. I would say that France is now entering, fortunately, a period of somewhat more rapid growth again, and I would expect that the mere fact that unemployment is beginning to fall will already have some effect on French attitudes. But it is not, I share your concern.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Niels. I have to say that there was one sentence, I think, in your presentation that gave me a frisson, which was where I think you suggested that the Monetary Policy Committee should be asked to assess the conjuncture that would apply between an exchange rate stability and an inflation outcome. I'm not sure that anyone is capable of answering that question very easily. But anyhow, before I welcome you to a reception upstairs on the fifth floor, may I ask you to join me in thanking Niels for a most valuable and worthwhile paper and for answering the questions afterwards so fully and frankly. Thank you very much indeed, Niels. Oh, and by the way, this is his book.
Thank you very much.